the Code Newbie podcast. We talk to people on their coding journey in hopes of helping you on yours. I'm your host, Saran, and today we're talking about the cloud with Erica Windisch, principal engineer at New Relic and founder of IOPipe.
It's very interesting to see how radically different these clouds are based on types of companies that they are and decisions that they make as a result of that.
In this episode, Erica talks about some of the history of the cloud, some of the major cloud providers, and what things as a newbie you might want to consider when deciding to use the cloud. After this. Are you looking to connect with a diverse audience of developers? Look no further. You can partner with us here at the Code Newbie Podcast, and we'll help get your message out to our incredible listeners in an ad just like this one, led by me, your host. Contact us by emailing sponsors@codenewbie.org. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So we're going to really dive deep into clouds, but before we do all of that, tell us about your personal coding journey.
This was fairly long ago. I am kind of the Oregon Trail generation. So, you know, we had Apple II computers with Oregon Trail and Number Munchers and all the MELC games. What was really great was with that push for STEM that we had in those late 80s and early 90s, was that math textbooks, and I don't know if they still do this today, which is like, you know, programming examples. So, you know, in the back of chapters in my math book, they would have examples of how you could, you know, write a program that would do something like solve Pythagorean's theorem or squaring numbers, for instance. You know, so it gave examples of not only how you would do these things on paper and do, you know, your exercises in class, but how you can write programs on the computer to do those things. And while I didn't really have a computer and the only computer I had was in school and they made us play educational games, I still had access to those examples and I would read through them and found them really interesting.
And what was your first coding job? How did that happen?
So my first job in tech wasn't even a coding job. It was a systems administration position. I had just quit school. I went to, for 1 year, to a university in Florida, Florida Institute of Technology. And I left there with really no plans. And I was looking for a job and kind of struggling to find something. And out of nowhere, a company up in Scranton, Pennsylvania, of all places, reaches out. And they were building a data center for web hosting. And they were basically building what would now be potentially considered, you know, a cloud. And they even had a lot of automation around that through an application called cPanel. So I came on as a systems administrator, as do a combination of support, actual system administration, keep the systems up and running, keep them operating, building new systems, both the hardware and the software side of those things. So I did a lot of things. So I, you know, I did stuff everywhere from understanding, you know, the power constraints of those servers and, you know, physically building them out and helping plan the power architecture for those data centers and the network architectures, but also like the applications that were running on them and the security of customer applications that ran on those machines.
So let's start off with some basics. Let's define just what the cloud even is. How would you describe it?
I think I've heard it described before as running on somebody else's computer, right?
Mm-hmm.
You want to be able to take your applications and run them somewhere else. I think that we've seen a lot of evolution of that concept over time. When I first started in what we called at the time web hosting, we wanted to meet developers where they were. And this is the interesting thing about what cloud development and evolution kind of is that as companies providing products to users, you have to meet those users where they are. So, you know, in 2001, we didn't have virtualization, not the way that we do now. We didn't have a lot of the same access controls and security mechanisms between processes on a machine. We didn't have containers, for instance, back in 2001. So at the time, though, you know, I could argue it was cloud from some degree, especially once we started adding automation. And this was when they started using the term cloud, was when we were able to have programmatic access, APIs, for creating those resources to have a place to run your application, have a place to store your data, right? To do that programmatically. And this is why, you know, things like, you know, iCloud have always been kind of controversial within like the Cloudarati type space of, it doesn't really give, you know, a user definable API if it's not something that developers are really building around. Is it cloud? And, you know, there's been lots of debates around this. It's really hard to fight, the marketing machines of a company like Apple when they make something like iCloud. And I think that has created a lot of confusion in the market. But originally, you know, cloud was defined as programmatic infrastructure for your applications. And another really key aspect to this, because there was early in cloud or late pre-cloud, however we define it, you know, we had combinations of this. We had companies where you could access the billing via API, but not the infrastructure, right? It would trigger like a request order to get a server created. And then like there were still physical or manual aspects of that creation. You had things where you could programmatically do some things via the API and not others. And the billing aspect is a really key part of this, because it's not just being able to create those things programmatically, but to be able to have those things affect billing programmatically as well. And the ever-increasing granularity of time. So we're at a point now where AWS can bill you for resources by the millisecond. And when EC2 first launched, I believe it was by the hour, right? So they would round you up to the nearest hour. And then they were rounding you up, you know, to the nearest minute. And then they're rounding you up to the nearest 100 milliseconds.
Wow, yeah.
So this has been decreasing over time. And I don't know if the definition of cloud is a moving target as far as that's concerned. But I think that if we were to define a pre-cloud, it was, you know, kind of where it was still developing and still getting to a point where you can programmatically do that. An early cloud, again, was like, you know, an hour granularity maybe, where now it's milliseconds. And I think that's pretty key, though, to considering something as cloud. But inside of an organization, there's a whole other factor, right? Which is that when you deploy to the cloud, you know, as an individual developer or team member, you may not even have access or visibility to billing. And whether or not you're building applications in a way that auto scales, in a way that automatically grows and is scalable, because if you're not able to scale your application at a granularity of hours or milliseconds, are you building a cloud application or not? Because we used to call this the pets versus cattle conversation. Mm-hmm. Building applications that are not just running on a cloud, but that are cloud native, that these applications are built and designed to take advantage of the cloud, right? It's like building an application for a single machine that takes advantage of a single processor or multiprocessor, right? You know, to be able to build that multi-threaded, parallelized design that supports distributed computing semantics and concepts is a skill in and of itself. And is this other kind of dividing line in terms of what is cloud? Because you can run things on the cloud that are not really cloud native or not designed for cloud.
You know, I've heard the definition of the cloud being, as you said, it's just being on someone else's machine. Why would I want to do that? Why would I want to do my stuff, run my processes on someone else's machine?
Mostly capital expenditures, right? Like that's the business answer. Businesses have wanted to move to cloud computing largely because it changes something on the budget from a capital expenditure, which is going to be purchasing a server for 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, and moving that to, you know, a rental-based model where you use those things as needed. And there's a number of reasons for this. You know, early on, it was simply, you know, a fiduciary budgetary matter. But as cloud has become adopted and as the granularity of billing has become more accessible, you know, smaller timeframes, and as APIs have developed and become more advanced, and developers have learned how to take advantage of these, and we have tools like, you know, advanced CI/CD systems that we didn't have in the 2000s or the 90s that can deploy these things, that can auto-scale these things. We have things like serverless that automatically grow and shrink according to your load, that the way we can build applications has changed. Because having a capital expenditure to have a machine and add capacity and plan out the capacity in that growth for, you know, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, and then saying, we're going to have this amount of growth, and then we're going to buy new machines every, you know, 6 months or whatever to keep up with that growth. There's a lot of overhead that you're removing, right? Mm-hmm, but you're also just being able to be super dynamic, right? When you have like a Black Friday event, you don't need to buy machines in September, set them up and build them so you can handle that load, so you can then sell them on the secondary market in December, right? Which is what companies have done in the past, right? Or they would repurpose those machines for other tasks. All of those problems kind of go away. You need less staffing, you need less operations, at least in those places. You know, you're able to potentially put those resources in other places or use them other ways. And developers have been so much enabled by having these tools and being able to grow things at scale rather than spending months or years also planning the growth and scaling of these applications. When you can, you know, put that into the architecture and design to make sure that it builds and scales, but it does that much more automatically than it used to.
So another word that comes up a lot when we're dealing with the cloud, and you mentioned it as well, is the word serverless. What does serverless mean, and what's the relationship between that and the cloud?
So serverless is the concept of, rather than renting access to a host machine running an operating system, like normally you would get a virtual machine, and that virtual machine runs an operating system. It can run Windows, it can run Linux, could theoretically run Android, but you would have to then take that machine, install the operating system, install software on that operating system, and that software includes things like your dependencies and your actual application, and then you have to operate and manage that operating system, so you need to monitor it and observe it, understand if it's having problems. And you know, with the model I was describing earlier with the cloud, the cloud native applications with this scalability in developer and DevOps and through CI/CD, we have gotten to a point where sometimes it's easier now to just shut down a machine than to really have deep observability of that machine. However, serverless takes us a step further and says, give us your application, give us your code, and we're going to run it. And it really harkens back earlier to the web hosting that I did in like 2001. Where developers back then, we didn't give them virtual machines. We gave them an account to put their application code on. So they would take their code, you know, from CVS or Bitbucket or any of these other non-Git-based code repositories, because we didn't have Git at the time. And they would take that code and they would upload it to a server, usually through FTP, which is File Transfer Protocol, and extract those files and run them out of a shared web hosting server like Apache. And now what you might do instead with a host, and this was a really difficult transformational time that I went through in like 2004 through 2006, and for some organizations, probably as late as 2010, of going from that model of uploading just your code and your application to having to now build out an operating system and install Apache or other web servers. So it became a much bigger problem, right? To give developers more control and more power, what we did was we said, well, don't just give us your application then. Like, give us the whole machine. But it turns out building a whole machine is more difficult, right? It required more effort, it required more engineers, more skill. And serverless kind of turns it around again and says, well, what if we kind of go back originally to that old model, but we give you the API, we give you the auto-scaling, we give you all of those things that you wanted, but also you don't need to give us the operating system. And that's pretty powerful, and it kind of gives you the best of all of the worlds in some regards. With, of course, the fact that because you're not uploading your full operating system, you do have some constraints that you don't have like on a microservices type Docker-based system or a virtual machine-based system.
Is your company looking to connect with a diverse audience of developers? Look no further. The dev community is the go-to destination for developers to learn, connect, and support each other. You can share your message with the 15 million developers that visit every single month by using our powerful native advertising platform. To learn more, visit dev.to/advertise.
So now I want to look at some typical choices that developers either may have heard of or may be considering in terms of a cloud provider. I think that the big one we've probably all heard of is AWS, Amazon Web Services. Can you talk a little bit about what AWS is and why it's such a dominant player in the field?
I guess the most obvious answer is Amazon. Right?
But it's interesting because, you know, Amazon, I still think it is weird that Amazon is in cloud. Like, Amazon is not supposed to be in cloud, right? Like, it's supposed to be books and toilet paper, you know, two-day delivery or sometimes next-day delivery. So the fact that it even got into this, you know, field and got into cloud is just, it's just still fascinating to me.
Yeah, you know, I kind of look at Amazon in some ways as solving logistics problems, inventory problems. They're managing all that inventory. They're managing all of these resources and providing an infrastructure for all of those things, you know, even to the point that they even now have their own delivery services. And the cloud in some ways, you know, is that kind of infrastructure for all businesses, right, to build. You know, it almost seems more strange to me that, you know, Google and Microsoft are doing these things. Maybe not so much Microsoft. I think it actually makes a lot of sense that Microsoft is doing it. But it's very interesting to see how radically different these clouds are based on types of companies that they are and the decisions that they make as a result of that. You know, Amazon has become almost a warehouse for all sorts of different technologies. And I think Google and Microsoft have done a much better job at kind of focusing on this is an opinionated way that you build an application, especially Google, I think has been really, this is the way that you build an application and here are tools to build applications in this specific way. And Amazon is much more of a warehouse of all sorts of tools in your toolbox. And a lot more of those tools overlap. And there isn't necessarily one best way to build your application on Amazon. It is, here are all the tools, go build a house, good luck. And, you know, there are advantages to that, right? Because when you have all sorts of different houses that you want or all sorts of different buildings that you want to make, because maybe it turns out you're not building a house. Maybe it turns out that you are building an office building, right? You're building a skyscraper or you're building a shed. And Amazon really does have arguably the widest set of tools to build any sort of application that you're looking to build.
Are these options, when it comes to cloud computing, are we talking about a tool, a place where it really is for advanced developers, it's really for our intermediate, more senior folks, or is there a place for beginners, for newbies to use cloud? Does it even make sense to enter this domain?
I think that is necessary for, well, maybe not for all developers. You know, I can make an argument that it's not really necessary for mobile developers. It's not necessary for embedded developers. It's not necessary even for a lot of front-end developers, although I think that for front-end developers, it is a very strongly desirable skill. You know, you need to at least be able to know things like S3. And, you know, when you are starting to move into back-end services, and full stack development is where you start to say, well, I need to be able to run my application. Because if you're a mobile developer, for instance, you're going to deploy your application to people's phones. If you are a backend developer, you're going to deploy the application to the cloud. That's just where your applications run if you're a backend, you know, like systems developer. But sure, I mean, there's, you know, people who develop desktop applications, mobile applications, embedded, et cetera, that you don't necessarily need to have these skills, they can become very useful, though, as soon as you need any sort of backend, you know, service architecture, where you need something like a centralized database for many users or an organization or across multiple organizations. And honestly, even for just, you know, smaller teams. Although, if you're building a small application for just a few users, depending on where you're using it and how you're using it, you could sometimes even get away with using Google Sheets as your API and your database, right?
Yeah.
I've done it. I've done it at New Relic. You know, not for our customer data and for, you know, our product, but when we are building and shipping applications and we're doing early access programs, you know, we can keep track of certain information related to product development and project management inside of Google Spreadsheets, and then we can automate some of our operations processes based on those spreadsheets during those early access programs. And then, you know, when we go live with those programs, those tools become available to everybody, and they just become part of the standard databases and so forth, and authorizations and access for all customers. But, you know, we can manage some of those things through things as simple as a Google Sheet when, you know, you have literally a, you know, a dozen people.
So there is a place for newbies to kind of get into cloud. Of the top, you know, cloud providers of AWS, we have Google Cloud, Gatsby Cloud, Azure, Netlify. These are some of the top ones. Do you have a recommendation of which one is, you know, is there one that's a little bit more newbie friendly that has a maybe an easier get started process?
I think it really depends on what you're shipping. For instance, I heard, you know, Gatsby and Netlify. Those are very much focused primarily on deploying front-end resources, which are going to be static web hosting, you know, HTML files, et cetera, you know, JavaScript files, CSS files, you know, just static assets. Those providers make a lot of sense for those resources. But when you're thinking about things like databases, for instance, you start to become much more restricted. So as soon as you need to start doing things like stream processing, databases, you have to start thinking, well, where am I going to run this and how am I going to run this? DigitalOcean is kind of famous for being a very easy to access and use cloud that offers you virtual machines and even now places to run containers, where if you can build a container or a virtual machine, you can go and ship it and run it on DigitalOcean with not too much trouble. I don't know where they are with databases, for instance, you know, if they even have any, and maybe they do, but I imagine it's probably fewer options than you have at AWS. And, you know, the old-fashioned way of doing this might be, you know, like, let's say you're on DigitalOcean, you would spin up a virtual machine running MySQL, but now you have to operate and maintain and worry about this MySQL instance that is running on top of a virtual machine or even a container on top of a virtual machine. On DigitalOcean, you have to maintain all of those things. And you know, there's a lot of advantages to going to AWS and spinning up an RDS cluster for MySQL, maybe paying a little bit more, you know, paying a little bit of a tax there for having a fully managed service, but you get a MySQL endpoint. And you largely don't have to manage it. You know, they even have, you know, tools for doing backups and restores and all those things. So depending on what you're deploying, it can be really advantageous to choose a provider that maybe isn't the most convenient or easy, but has the things that are actually going to make things easier for you in the long term. Or, you know, doing a little bit of a hybrid approach. You know, there's definitely lots of companies that use like a Netlify or a Gatsby Cloud with DigitalOcean and AWS. I would say those are probably more smaller organizations or individuals, because as you get larger, most companies want to really try and standardize on one of the big clouds. And of course, you know, the behemoth here is AWS, and most employers are going to want AWS experience or want you to build AWS experience once you're on a job.
Why is that? Why is AWS so popular? Why is it number one?
Again, it comes a lot down to the tools that are available to you on that cloud. They just have, you know, such a wide set of tools available for you to use. They also have a really great set of access controls. They have FedRAMP compliance and GovCloud access for those that are doing, you know, federal work in any capacity. The thing about AWS Cloud is that it is arguably the hardest of those clouds to use. It is the least user-friendly. There have been a lot of improvements to that over time, but it is kind of, you know, for better or worse, you know, the de facto standard, I think. Certainly there are organizations that, you know, use the other clouds, but most organizations are going to use AWS. And I would say it's worth getting to know if you're going to be doing any sort of backend development, and that includes, you know, what I would personally would consider full stack development.
So if I am a newbie developer, I'm going to, you know, test the cloud out for the first time, my first step into this venture, what should I consider? What are the questions maybe I should ask myself to help me decide which tool to use as my first tool?
So what I like to do is figure out, first of all, what it is that I'm building and what are the requirements for the thing that I'm building. For instance, let's say you're building a front-end website and it's going to talk to a back-end application. You're going to want to have an API for that. And actually, this probably applies also if you're building a mobile application and it talks to a back-end. You want to have an API to that service. That may be your only way of interfacing with that service. It may be, you know, just everything is, you know, kind of a CRUD interface. And that is like create, read, update, and delete CRUD through an API where you store that data, right? You know, a database has a CRUD API, not necessarily HTTP, but databases have those sorts of APIs. But you maybe want to do things on top of that database. You want to do things with the data. Some of your applications might have data ingest through another mechanism. And New Relic, we do a lot of APIs where the data comes from another source. So for instance, customers send us telemetry data through their application, and then our application talks to our APIs to retrieve the data that came from the customer's application, right? So we have this whole ingest layer and streaming processing that puts data into the databases, and then our applications are built on top of that API as mostly a read to really retrieve that information and display it. When you're doing that, you have to think about things like, for instance, performance. You know, there are lots of statistics on how quickly users want data back, right, when you load a page. And that can be very contextual, right? Because like when you go through like a process where you click a submit button and you put in a bunch of search parameters, it's usually acceptable to be a little, you know, slower. But when you look at even things like Google, right, you know, Google has a huge database and lots of data and they have very quick results. There are definitely lots of architectures that would not support, you know, a Google search use case because they would not have the kind of performance that you need. And in fact, you know, that kind of use case is probably very, you know, multi-layered in terms of what kind of results can it return and what kind of speed and, you know, on which page of results are you on, et cetera, where you know, in something like New Relic, you know, we can say that if you're looking for data from a month ago, it's probably more acceptable for the customer to wait more seconds than they want to wait for the last 60 minutes of data, where we want to return, you know, the last 60 minutes of data very quickly. And data from a month ago, we're willing to take some compromises on how quickly we return that data. So you have to come up with, you know, a data architecture. And this is where, you know, I think this can certainly become a specialization and a job in its own, and building and architecting data storage. And, you know, in the teams that I work with, you know, there's usually only one or two engineers that really understand deeply those sorts of problems and can build those solutions. And not everybody does, right? And, you know, that's a great opportunity for some of the newer developers or developers that are maybe not so new, but just don't have the domain expertise to learn, you know, from their coworkers or learn from those projects. But basically comes down to requirements, like what are performance, what are the costs too? Because costs, like on AWS, I mean, I've come up with two different architectures and, you know, they can just be very, very different in terms of cost. And sometimes you have to just pay the money.
So what are the big differences between the big providers? If I'm doing something very basic, that's not, you know, too, that doesn't require, you know, some type of ridiculous customization, that's pretty straightforward. Is there much of a difference between the big cloud providers? I mean, it feels like they mostly do the same thing, or maybe not. What do you think?
I think that Google has probably a really fantastic core set of services that you could build anything on top of. However, you may need to roll more of it on your own than you would on AWS. Like, for instance, you know, there might be database choices that AWS has that Google doesn't have. You can still run those databases on Google, but you're going to have to install those databases in an operating system and that operating system on a virtual machine and build, operate, deploy that, you know, manage all of that within your organization. And, you know, there's conveniences to not having to do those things. But I think Google provides all of the primitives that you need to do the things. Just, you might need to roll more of it on your own. What they do have is very user-friendly. Of course, there are exceptions, but I think that there is a happy path for Google Cloud where things kind of work and you can get the core of what you need. And I think it's designed with a lot of thought. And I just really enjoy using Google Cloud versus some of the others. I think DigitalOcean is another one that is also very convenient and easy to use, but maybe not, you know, as large. And, you know, finally, maybe not finally, but, you know, Microsoft is the other really big one. And Microsoft really focuses a lot on how they can have enterprise contracts, how they can solve problems for IT departments rather than application developers. You know, and the other side of it is for developers that Microsoft has really put a lot of thought into integrating Azure Cloud in with the developer tools. So if you're using VS Code or you're using Virtual Studio and, you know, increasingly even potentially GitHub, which is now a Microsoft product, that these products are going to integrate well together. And, you know, they're going to try and make it easy to move from one of these products to the other. And a lot of developers use these tools, right? You know, VS Code, Virtual Studio, and GitHub are very popular products. And, you know, when we talk about, you know, Microsoft Cloud, you know, I think that it isn't completely unfair to even consider GitHub and GitHub's version of CI/CD, which is GitHub Actions, arguably as cloud services. And, you know, I think there's a lot of use for these services, especially as they integrate. And Microsoft has a fairly decent set of things that they solve, but, you know, they also do tend to, they support Linux, but a lot of things do lean towards Windows. And they lean towards a lot of this IT operations sort of problems and enterprise contracts. A lot of what they do is try and really go around and solve your billing problems more so than your technical problems. So a lot of times I see that Microsoft is chosen for billing reasons, for cost reasons, and not necessarily for technical reasons or developer happiness.
Coming up next, Erica talks about what she thinks the future of the cloud might look like after this. So I'm curious what you think the future of cloud computing is going to be. What's the next version of the cloud?
Yeah, AI-assisted development is going to become more prevalent. And I think that AI-assisted operations and management and observability is really going to become important. I think that the companies in that space are barely, you know, like we're just touching, you know, the beginning of that, right? GPT-3 itself, you know, and you know, the new GitHub service, Codepilot, for instance, you know, is just the really beginning of that iceberg. And I'm really excited to see where that goes. You know, it isn't cloud exactly. You know, I think that what we need from the cloud, and I might regret saying this, but I feel like what we need from the cloud is kind of there. I mean, arguably, even what we have with EC2 was mostly enough, right? Like we started adding on layers. We added on, you know, higher level abstractions. We went from EC2 to containers to serverless. I don't think that there is going to be a more serverless. I mean, there'll be improvements and you know, it's going to become more optimized and so forth. But I don't think that we're going to have like a huge net change from that. I think that building and deploying those things is going to change. Because remember, this whole journey is about getting your developers to write better code faster, right? More code, better code, faster, speeding up the development cycle. I mean, that's what companies want. It's what developers kind of want, kind of don't. One of the big barriers to this is that when I started IOPipe, we actually were looking at GPT-3-like algorithms for building applications. That was the original pitch. And what we found, the reason we didn't go down that path, when we went down observability, was that we found that developers want to write code. Mm-hmm. Like, they don't care about machines running code for them. They want to write code. And I think that what GitHub has done is interesting in that machines are writing code for you, but also you're still writing code yourself, right? Like, they're assisting you. They're speeding up that process.
Right. They're helping. They're not taking it over.
Exactly. And I think it's going to be a really interesting thing when we start to see aspects of development being taken over, because I think that's going to happen. And I think it's going to be a scary time for developers, you know, just in the same way that DevOps was very scary for a lot of developers. You know, a lot of developers were really scared that they were going to have to do any sorts of operations. And I think that it's even scarier to think that aspects of your job might go away with machines taking over, right? And it's going to be very limited at first, but over time, it's going to increase slowly but surely. And I don't know where we're going to end up, and I don't know how quickly it's going to happen, but, you know, we're kind of here. And I think that's the next step. A lot of things are going to, again, come down to, like, you know, architecture is not going to go away. You know, developers making decisions is not going to go away. Product managers making decisions, you know, design is not going away. And again, software development is not going away, but little tiny aspects of it, little tunings of it, certainly I think machines will be able to do, you know, in a short term time frame, you know, like, you know, things like, you know, make this ball roll in a game. Maybe there, you know, is already a library for make thing roll. And, you know, you don't need to necessarily Google, you know, for a library for something to roll. You know, maybe it's kind of, you know, in your tool set already.
Now, at the end of every episode, we ask our guests to fill in the blanks of some very important questions. Erica, are you ready to fill in the blanks?
I'll try.
Number one, worst advice I've ever received is?
So, I think when I was younger, I had a lot of people telling me that I wasn't valued what others were making because of what I was making, right? That the amount that you were making was a reflection of your ability rather than a reflection of your ability to negotiate or even your geographic location or because of other factors. And, you know, I was paid under market for some time and I did not really get a lot of great support in people telling me, oh yeah, you can go out, you know, and get that money. Like, yes, like you're being underpaid. I instead had people telling me that, well, that's just what you're worth because that is what you're making. And I really wish I had better access to people, you know, who were successful in tech, who were willing to be transparent about salaries, willing to be transparent around compensation and titles and things like that in this industry.
Mm-hmm. Number two, best advice I've ever received is?
So yeah, unfortunately, I have the memory of a goldfish. And trauma is better at recording memories. So what I can maybe do is offer my own advice.
Okay, sure, go for it.
So, you know, I think it's important that you continue to learn and grow, especially about systems and architecture, but also how to navigate your job. Right? How do I communicate across teams, to coworkers, to your manager, and if you are a manager, to reports, and to make sure that you're getting the right titles and compensation. These are things that I learned very late into my career. I was probably closer to 15 years into my career before I really understood these things appropriately. You also need to understand equity, especially if you're ever going to work, well, really just in tech. Like, you should be getting equity. And if you're not, you're probably at the wrong employer or you're at Netflix. and in which case, you're getting compensated for it instead, right? But like, unless you're getting Netflix compensation, you should be getting equity. And you need to understand equity and what that means. Because some, you know, RSUs are significantly different than startup equity. You know, I invested close to $50,000 into Docker between, you know, the cost to exercise and the taxation of that. You know, and that's money I saved up for years because I was not getting paid for directly to market for a long time. So that was a lot of money for me. And I lost all of it. You know, and Docker is by many measures a success, right? So even when you think that you have a startup, you know, or a product that is doing well, when you think you have a lot of potential, when you have a valuation, when you get in, a dollar and it goes to $10 and you're like, this is a sure bet, it isn't. And I would be extraordinarily careful. And honestly, probably the best advice I can give is not to work for a startup and to actually work for one of these large corporations right now that are just, handing out RSUs, which is not completely guaranteed, but it's fairly safe, much more than, taking a pay cut to work for a startup and then getting startup equity. That's not going to be worth anything. It wasn't until later that I realized a lot of people, that take those jobs were, people that were coming from more affluent situations where, they could take those risks, where I was thinking that I was bootstrapping.
Number three, my first coding project was about?
My first one was a run box for launching applications from a window manager called FBWM. And that was back in around 97. So it's a very simple application and it just popped up a window and it had a text box in it. And you could type in the name of an application on your computer or a command. And then there was a button for run and it would run that application for you. Super simple, super basic. It was a really great introductory application to develop. But it was also something that I needed because back then, desktop environments, for Linux at least, were not all-encompassing things that did everything, that had all of the tools and things that you needed. So something as simple as a run box was not something that was actually necessarily provided by my operating system. And it was a very simple utility that I actually had a need for. So I read it.
Number four, one thing I wish I knew when I first started to code is
how much I would always rely on the references and documentation. I do not remember all of the syntax and all of the standard libraries for all the languages that I have ever learned. In fact, there are absolutely languages that I have learned, forgotten, learned again, and forgotten again. I'm sure that there are people that do memorize these things. And I've had periods where I was deeply engaged on a project and was writing code daily and, got into a rhythm and didn't have to check those reference materials as often. However, I have always checked those reference materials, even in those times, for all sorts of things. And I think that starting new programming languages is always a shift. Returning the programming languages is a shift. Starting new projects, where you have to do something new, whether it's talking to a new database or using an old database in a new way or anything else, like, you're going to have to look up those things. You're going to have to do some more learning and more research, and you're going to have to reconnect the dots. And I think that's normal.
Absolutely. Well, thank you again so much, Erica, for joining us.
Sure. Thank you.
This show is produced and mixed by Levi Sharp. You can reach out to us on Twitter at CodeNewbies or send me an email, hello@codenewbie.org. Join us for our weekly Twitter chats. We've got our Wednesday chats at 9 p.m. Eastern Time and our weekly coding check-in every Sunday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. For more info on the podcast, check out www.codenewbie.org/podcast. Thanks for listening. See you next week.